Hello and welcome to History Lesson Part 2. I'm Jackson McDonald.
I'm Tyler Shipley.
The film we will be discussing today is the 2019 film Ready or Not, directed by Matt Bettinelli-Olpin and Tyler Gillett, and starring Samara Weaving, Adam Brody, Mark O'Brien, Henry Cherney, and Andy McDowell. Real ensemble cast in this one. We're doing this episode because it is the date today is October 20th, and we wanted to do a spooky season themed episode, given that Halloween is just around the corner, and there are plenty of really great horror or horror adjacent movies that I think will be worth talking about as we get through more and more episodes of this show. So I guess a good place to start as any. We'll get into the sort of plot of the movie in a second and the production notes, but Tyler, I guess the first thing I'll just ask you is what did you, without giving too much away, like, what did you think of this?
Yeah, I liked it. I enjoyed it. It was, I felt like it was a solid, I mean, I'll give my final grade on it at the end, but I felt like I was entertained throughout. Yeah, I don't feel like it was a film that changed my life, but I felt like I enjoyed it as I was watching it. And, you know, obviously the thing I liked the most about it was that it was a very, very blunt criticism of basically capitalism and specifically the rich, actually. Yes. Like, it was like as much of as anything, it was a criticism of like inherited aristocratic wealth. And it was like, it was straight up. There was no mistaking it. There was no misunderstanding what was happening. It was just like, here's a bunch of rich psychopaths, and they're psychopathic in different ways. And it's because they're rich.
Yeah.
And it's like wrapped up in that.
Yeah.
Super satisfying.
It was, I found it very satisfying too. I suggested this movie literally when I was halfway through watching it. I just messaged Tyler and I was like, we should probably do an episode on this movie, because there was a point when I was watching it where I was like, this is a perfect movie. I'm going to give this 5 stars. And then my opinion of it changed as it went along, particularly at the end, which, once again, not going to give that away. We will get into that as we go through the plot of the movie. But basically what I liked about it is that I really do believe that there are basically two types of billionaires. The first is the one, and I shouldn't say there's two types. There's two main types, and then you have a Venn diagram where there's definitely a large chunk of overlap. But there's the billionaires who bond over child sex rituals, and the billionaires who bond over satanic murder rituals, basically. And since you can't really make a movie about the first camp, it's really kind of a shame that it took so long for somebody, at least to the best of my knowledge, to make a movie about the second camp. You know, I think the only other example of this sort of idea of a rich family or a group of rich people, like, literally basically preying on the poor or a poor person for sport that I can think of is The Most Dangerous Game. And that was years and years and years and years and years ago, old enough to have been an old movie at the time of The Zodiac Killer. So I can only imagine how old it must be.
I mean, it's funny, though. OK, so it's funny that you say that, because for me, I actually think that this film, I mean, you know, the satanic part maybe specifically, sure, you know, sets it aside. But I actually thought, like, I didn't watch it and think, oh, damn, this is fresh. This is a fresh idea.
Yeah, fair enough.
You know, like, and I think, you know, in some ways, and this is something I want to talk about, I think this movie kind of fits into a broader thing that's happening in pop culture, where we hate and fear rich people again, as we always should have.
Yes.
But it got forgotten, I think, somewhere in the pop culture of the 80s and 90s, and, you know, the worship of Wall Street and the kind of just, you know, suburban decay. You know, you think about the big movies of the 90s, a lot of stuff about like the suburbs, and there wasn't a ton of really, really rich anti-capitalist stuff happening. And in the last, I want to say, decade or so, hating the rich, explicitly hating the rich, for being psychopathic, like, it's having a cultural resurgence. And I'm thinking of, and I think some of these movies are even maybe perhaps I would say better than this one that we just watched.
Yep.
You know, a movie like Get Out, you know, thematically very similar. I think a superior film because it also has that element of like racial capitalism. But
sure.
You know, but it's sort of in that kind of category. Knives Out.
Which I haven't seen.
Okay. Well, good. You should. Yep. Yeah. Yep. You would like it. It's a similar kind of scenario of like rich psychopathic family. They've all got their different psychoses, you know, and they're involved in some shady, sordid shit. And, you know, not quite, I don't think quite gets to the satanic level, but
sure. Yes. I think the only other movie that I can think of that very sort of explicitly follows like the same idea of, and the thing is, I know it exists and I know it's been used before, but I just can't think of very many examples. But the only other movie I can kind of think of that is like rich people either like use their wealth to, you know, kill poor people for fun, for sport, or like a some sort of variation on that is probably like the Hostel movies, which I remember seeing a long, long time ago and thinking they were very bad. But my opinion might change if I were to watch them again now. It's a good idea. It's like, it is a trope, but it's an underused one, I feel like, or one that kind of fell out of fashion for a while.
It did. That's the thing. It fell out of fashion for a long time and it's back. And I think like it's back for reasons that make sense that like I'll probably want to contextualize a little bit, but you know, I'm even thinking, you know, this is TV, but Squid Game, which was this, hugely popular Korean show, I think last year.
I really want to watch that as well.
And again, I mean, fundamentally, that's a show about like rich people putting poor people through the fucking ringer, and in most cases, like to their death, essentially for their own entertainment. You know, even Parasite, again, like, you know, stretching back to Korean film, but Parasite, again, hugely popular. And, you know, it wasn't that director's first anti-capitalist film, but the fact that it suddenly got popular, like there's something different at this stage. We're in a different place in pop culture. We're ready to be like, yeah, you know what? The rich people absolutely would like hunt us for sport and have fun with it and feel no, you know, qualms about it, which I think has always been the case, but it's just, it's very, very clear these days.
Totally. We should talk about, Bong Joon-ho or Snowpiercer or Parasite or, you know, however we want to do it at some point, because Bong Joon-ho is interesting in that I've seen, two big, you know, anti-capitalist thematically movies in, certainly Western movies in Parasite and Snowpiercer. Parasite isn't a Western movie, but it was created with a Western audience in mind, I think, in a way that a lot of his other Korean language movies haven't been. And those would be interesting to talk about because I've seen both of them and I didn't really like either of them for reasons that I guess we'll parse out in a future episode. But
That's good. Well, and you'll have to watch, there's a couple of others you'll have to watch, and we should just do like a full episode just on his him. Films. Okja is really good.
That's the one that I'm interested in seeing because that's sort of the other one. And it has almost like an environmental theme from what I understand to it as well. Right?
Factory farming's kind of getting
interesting. I would love to see that for sure.
But see, this is it. Like these are the films that are like starting to kind of become like saturate into pop culture in a way that is different from before that we didn't have. And, you know, a lot of the ones that we just been talking about have been pretty big hits here. So
absolutely. Yep.
This movie, Ready or Not, felt like it was part of that. And I wouldn't say that it was, you know, in the top tier of it, but it certainly wasn't bad either. It was like a solid middling contribution to that to that new kind of canon of anti-capitalist, you know, movies. And also it was fun. Like, it was
very fun. Yes.
It was a lot of fun. It was really entertaining. And I think, I mean, I'll be interested also to know what it is that you didn't like at the end. I think it'll probably be the same thing. There was something I also didn't like at the end.
Yeah, totally. I have a feeling we're going to have the same reading on it. Which is why I'm interested to get into in the future, like, movies that I know we probably have different readings on. Because it hasn't happened so far, but I know it will. Like, eventually we're going to do Death of Stalin. That'll be a really fun one, because I know both have like very, very different opinions on that movie. And and the Bong Joon-ho stuff as well will be interesting. But before we get into the plot here, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the production of the movie. I don't have a ton here, but I was able to pull a couple of interesting things. One that I'm just going to get out of the way immediately because I thought it was so funny. Apparently, basically all of the blood and guts in this movie are actually made out of desserts.
Oh.
And Samara Weaving, the female lead, made a habit of in interviews repeating how delicious all the like blood and guts were, like amazing. Having to get sprayed with all the entrails and stuff. And then there is one scene at the very end, not, you know, obviously spoilers abound for this movie, as is always the case with all of our episodes, but there is one scene at the very end where you do see her kind of just like lick her lips for a second when she has blood all over her face. And I thought that was funny because I was like, oh, I wonder if that was intentional or if she just did that because she was like, it tastes good, you know?
That's amazing.
And another thing, this is probably my favorite thing that I learned, is that one of the producers of this movie is named James Vanderbilt. James Vanderbilt is of the Vanderbilt family, wow, who were once the richest family in the United States, which I think is very interesting because it's a, you know, I started a very brief film school micro credential last week. And the one thing that I've always kind of gotten the sense of just from the people I know who work in the movie industry, and then now especially having like been instructed now in a class by two different people who work in the film industry and stuff, if you don't hate the producers, you're probably like just a insanely obsequious person. Like, the producer is the boss. The producer is the guy who cares only about money, keeping it on schedule, doesn't give a shit about the artistry of it.
Yeah.
And so I thought it was very funny that they essentially like made this movie that may as well be about one of the guys who produced it.
And they it's like they used Vanderbilt money to send up the Vanderbilts. That's
exactly
pretty funny.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what kind of resemblance the Vanderbilts bear to the Le Domases that are portrayed in the movie. But I mean, ultimately, right, like all of these rich families are basically the same, you know.
Yeah.
At least the waspy ones are all basically the same, you know, so I can't imagine it's too different.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think one of the things I liked about the film was that, and this is true of some of those other ones too, like Knives Out, was the way that they showed like different people within the umbrella of the rich aristocratic type wealthy family are going to have different types of sociopathy.
Yes.
But they ultimately are all going to land there. You know, by, you know, essentially by virtue. And I don't know that that's not a theoretical claim I would stand behind 100% of the time, but basically that being in that kind of rarefied, you know, social class, it almost inevitably, almost invariably is going to create these different sociopathic kind of tendencies, and some of which you can hide easily and some, you know, you can that are harder to hide. Actually, you know what else fits into this? And it's a TV show, but The White Lotus.
Oh, I don't know. I'm not familiar with that.
Oh, you've got to watch The White Lotus. It's so good. And I mean, see, it's partly because of things like The White Lotus that when I watched Ready or Not, I thought this is great, but it's not that top tier.
Yeah, sure.
Because something like White Lotus, which portrays a group of American tourists, rich tourists going to Hawaii on vacation for a week.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and this came out, you know, early in the pandemic, right when people in Hawaii were saying, please stop coming here and bringing your COVID and whatever else. And it does such a good job of, you know, each of the different characters, you know, they're all ultimately pretty rotten and pretty selfish and pretty harmful. But some of them hide it very well. Some of them even hide it behind very progressive, you know, sounding language. And I think that's what I really like about this new kind of stuff that's coming out. Ready or Not fits in that because the different rich people, like the, you know, the Vanderbilts or whomever they are, like they all end up being bad. They're just differently bad.
Yes. Right? And it's funny because I think what I will say is, you know, you said this isn't like a theoretical claim you would necessarily stand behind 100%. And we'll get to it a little bit later, but I do think there kind of is, certainly in this movie, and I think you could kind of probably argue in real life as well, there is sort of one exception that kind of proves the rule, that I think is portrayed very effectively in this movie. But I will also just add, while we're on the topic of, you know, rich person production notes, another thing that I learned that I thought was very interesting is that the Le Domas family mansion is actually a mansion that's sort of in your neck of the woods, Casa Loma in Toronto.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Are you familiar with Casa Loma?
Oh, yeah, of course. Everyone here knows Casa Loma. It's this silly fake castle that some rich people built to live in at some point.
So yeah. I have one interesting kind of story about Casa Loma, and I will just fill people in a little bit on the history because it is interesting. So Casa Loma is the largest private residence ever built in Canada. It originally belonged to Sir Henry Pellet, a Canadian financier who made his fortune investing in the Toronto Electric Light Company and the Cobalt Lake Mining Company. But his story actually has a very funny, happy ending, I would argue. So this is just from the Wikipedia article here. It sums it up very succinctly. So later in around 1915, using riches from his Cobalt Lake Mining Company, he invested in the fledgling McIntyre Mines in Timmins, Ontario. However, legislator Adam Beck launched a campaign against the great industrialists of Canada, proclaiming that hydropower, quote, should be as free as air. Through legislative processes and by whipping up anti-rich sentiment, Beck was able to successfully appropriate Pellet's life's work and take his electric companies from him. Beck then led a populist revolt to raise Pellet's taxes on his estate, Casa Loma, from $600 per year to $12,000 per year.
That rules.
The strain of losing all his income, coupled with the large increase in property taxes for his castle, led him to rely solely on his real estate investments, which were unsuccessful due to the beginning of the First World War. After the province expropriated his electrical power generating business and his aircraft manufacturing business was appropriated by Beck as part of the effort during the First World War, Pellet was driven to near bankruptcy, which forced him and Lady Pellet to leave Casa Loma in 1923.
That rules.
Very, very funny.
Yeah, that's so good. And so perfect that the film is made there in
absolutely
that context. Yeah.
The location scout for this movie did a good job. There's also most of the movie was filmed in Toronto in and around whatever the fucking ritziest neighborhood is there. Probably I didn't, look into what I can't remember the name of it exactly off the top of my head. But yeah, it was filmed all basically around in a ritzy neighborhood in Toronto, which I liked that. That felt like a nice touch for me, you know?
Yeah. It's funny because normally when stuff is shot in Toronto, I recognize it. And it happens a lot. There's a lot of stuff being made here now. The Boys was all filmed in Toronto.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, lots of big things. But it's funny that I did not recognize it in that because clearly I'm not hanging out in those neighborhoods.
Yeah, so, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, well, it's very much the same thing with, like, I mean, obviously tons of shit is filmed in BC, particularly in Vancouver, but increasingly also in Victoria, where I live. And we'll actually get into that a little bit more in a second. But yeah, it's very much the same thing for me. It's interesting to see in some stuff, it's just so immediately painfully obvious, like, oh, that's Vancouver. I know where that is. I've been there. And then other times I'm like, you know, is this Vancouver? Is this like somewhere else in BC? Is this maybe just somewhere else in the Pacific Northwest? It's all kind of in the hands of the people who are doing the set dressing and et cetera, et cetera.
Speaking of which, I want to ask you, I mean, we'll get back to the film in one second, sure. But I want to ask you how the program's going. You mentioned that you're doing production thing.
I really like it so far. By the end of the course, you're basically supposed to be able to, like, they roll into it. There's like the regular course, and then they roll into it this other one-day course that you test for that is basically like, if you want to think of it as like, you know, if you want to work in a kitchen, you should probably have food safe.
Right.
If you want to be a bartender, you have to have serving it. Right. And that's kind of one of these courses is like that. It's a course you have to complete to be a PA, but I had a lot of fun. Like day one was just a lot of introductory stuff, but we got to do this exercise where you look through a script and basically the instructor assigns you a department or two and says, okay, you're going to look at this script, and I'll just use mine as an example. The one that I did, because it's the one that I did. So they gave us the script for, it's the opening scene from Legally Blonde. And he says, okay, you guys are the background department. Background is the new word that they use for extras. Because as they put it, like, the term extra is kind of shitty because it implies that you are extraneous. Like, it implies that you are an add-on. And when the reality is, like, even though you don't have a speaking part, even though you're clearly several tiers below any actor who has a speaking part, you actually are still essential to the scene. They couldn't have the scene without you. So they call you background now instead of extras.
That's nice.
So that was one department. And then the other department was costumes. And so you just go through the script and you list off every reasonable assumption you could make about what you will need for costumes and for background characters. And so, you know, you go through and just be like, oh, okay, so we have a jock here, so I want a Letterman jacket for that guy. Person or whatever. And I found that really fun. Like, cool. It's kind of, you know, rewarding people who are detail oriented or whatever, which I'm not for most things, but I am for that kind of thing. And then on day two, I literally just basically learned what every single person in the credits of a movie does, which was dry, but also interesting. I feel like I have a way better idea of how shit gets made now than I did even, you know, a week ago or whatever.
Great. That's awesome.
So I think we can pretty much get into the plot of the movie here.
Yeah, let's do it.
I didn't write one out like I did for the last episode. I don't think there's going to be as much granular detail here. I'm going to go mostly off of my recollection, but, you know, we may jump in and out of order a little bit just because I'm not sure if I'm going to remember every single scene. But we open on a what appears to be like a post wedding sort of, I guess you could say, honeymoon suite type thing going on. It's not really clear. It becomes more clear later. We have a couple who, you know, appear to be getting married in and around, I guess, the late 80s. Although I will say that when my wife and I first watched this, I was immediately like, I'm sorry, does this take place in Victorian times? Did I miss that? And then my wife and I argued for like 5 minutes about, she's like, no, it's just taking place in the 80s. And then I was like, well, then why is this guy dressed like a waiter? and we like argued about it for 5 minutes until I finally had to concede that, yes, it is in fact just the opening scene does just take place in the 80s. And that's just how,
that's how rich people dressed in the 80s.
Yeah. Exactly. At weddings anyways. And so it's just a very brief opening scene where there's the groom appears to be wounded, and the groom comes into contact with a child, and, you know, it looks like for a second he and the child are going to, you know, work together to like save him or help him or whatever. But instead, The child just screams, like letting everyone know that this is where this guy is. And then these people in masks come out of the woodwork and kill, and take him away to kill him. It's very obvious that that's what they're going to do. And then end scene, we cut forward 30 years later to another wedding day, this time between the star of the movie, Grace, played by Samara Weaving, and her her husband, or husband-to-be, Alex, who is the sort of, I guess you could say, semi-estranged son of, I believe it is Becky and Tony Ledomas, who are the basically the patriarch of the Ledomas family and his wife. The Ledomas family are, I guess you could say, basically board game magnates, it seems like, is the, which is a very funny, it's very funny to me to think that, like, that kind of family, I don't know, would have this kind of like wealth now.
Yeah, I know. And it was a funny, you know, of all the, you expect it to be like, oh, you know, they own all the electricity companies, or, you know, they own all the telecommunications. The fact that they're a board game, you know, that they're from big board game, you know, but I actually like it because it reminded me, you mentioned The Most Dangerous Game.
Yes.
And I have to think that the makers of this film have that in mind. I mean, of it's course. The archetype, right? It is the story that sort of shapes our understanding of rich people hunting poor people.
Yes.
And
yeah.
And so to have them be a game company, or a family that owns a game company, and to have the satanic ritual stuff kind of rooted through games and the playing of games, I actually thought that was really clever and satisfying as someone that is into games and board games.
Sure.
So I was like, oh, yeah, this is fun, actually.
Well, and the fact that the family are from a board game family is totally integral to the plot and to the events of the movie, because what essentially happens is we're introduced to each of the individual members of the family. I'm going to try to remember them all and list them all off. We have, so I mentioned Alex. He's the sort of seemingly normal one who is getting married to Grace. Doesn't seem to have much of a relationship with his family. I mentioned Becky, played by Andy McDowell. She's the matriarch. She is also, you know, I'm trying to think of the best way to describe her characterization. She's sort of a modern like twist on the rich guy's wife. She's not distant. She's motherly. She's loving, but in a very like kind of disgusting sort of coddling way, I would say, in my opinion.
Yeah, and she's also interesting too, because, you know, we're going to meet this family and they're all this kind of blue blood type family, but of course, like, in each couple, there's one person who is of the family and one person who's been brought into the family, and that becomes significant. And so it's significant that the mother is one of the people who's been brought into the family, and, you know, we're given to believe didn't necessarily come from the same kind of wealth.
Exactly.
Right. Which, you know, what I like about a film like this is the way that it shows us the different faces of of psychopathic rich people. And this is one of those. A person who marries into it is a little uncomfortable with it, but then decides, oh, you know what? No, yeah, I kind of like this. I'm kind of into this, and embraces it later, which I think is sort of her role there.
Yes, certainly. And then Tony, the father, the head of the house, played by Henry Cherney, I believe that's how you pronounce his last name, is he's a wasp's wasp. He complains later on in the movie when the killing starts and it's not going well. He complains that he has an 8 a.m. tea time the next morning. He's very obsessed with the tradition of the family when it suits him, and then when it doesn't suit him, immediately willing to cut and run. And try, you know, just do whatever's necessary to get the whole thing over with.
He's an aristocratic psychopathic version of Tony Soprano.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
because he's like annoyed by the whole thing at some level. He's just like, he's tired of it. He's sick of it. You know, he's got to do these fucking rituals and he's sick of doing these fucking rituals, but we have to do the fucking rituals because Satan's going to come and get us if we don't. Like, yes. It's like he's sick of it, but also at in some moments, like he is it and he can't not be it. Right.
Yeah. It's like, it's very much like the, it's very much the same vibe when you see, like Barack Obama tweet about how terrible the state of the world is or something, or or how awful it is, and you just want to go like, you were literally a fucking two-term president. You're the reason it's like this. And it's very much the same the same kind of thing with Tony Soprano and with Tony LaDomas, which is where you have that sense of like, oh man, it sure does suck that it has to be like this. And it's like, that has to, who do you're the fucking reason that it's like this. So then we also have Daniel LaDomas, who is played by Adam Brody, and his wife Charity. So Daniel is the drunk fail son. Just alcoholic, does not take anything seriously, dripping with sarcasm and contempt for everyone around him at basically every moment in the movie. This is contrasted with his wife, Charity, who I think is sort of the opposite side of the coin in comparison to Andy McDowell's character, the mother, right?
Yeah.
Because where is Andy McDowell? Whereas she is like, she has the good sense, she has the decency to seem like she's squeamish about the nastier aspects of the family. Charity loves it.
Yeah.
She's great. She's the most, she might be the most psychotic out of all of them. Which is very interesting. And she does hint at later on the idea that her life before she met Daniel was perhaps a life of some sort of hardship. It's never explained.
Mm-hmm.
And I always kind of, I think it's, it would be interesting to kind of float some different theories, because it would seem to imply that she's saying that she was really poor or something, or that her life was really hard. But at the same time, when you see how she's characterized, like, I wouldn't be surprised if her idea of like, oh, my life was so hard, was like, my family only owned one car.
Exactly. You know? Well, you know, like, and this is, so I mean, I got that sense from her.
Yeah.
And, but when I said earlier that I found this movie was good, but not quite in the top tier of its class of this type of movie.
Yeah.
You know, thinking about The White Lotus, the main character in The White Lotus is this very sympathetic young woman who is also like engaged to a psychopathic rich guy. And he's obviously a psychopathic rich guy, man, baby, everything you would expect. And she's our sympathetic kind of way into it, except that when she sort of frames herself as this like, oh God, you guys have all this money and I'm just, you know, I'm used to having a job and working and living normally. But as that sort of onion gets peeled back, you discover that it's like, oh, okay, so you were accustomed to like a very comfortably upper middle class life, and now you're in, you know, a castle. But that's not the same as being poor. Like that's not the same as going from rags to riches. That's going from riches to extreme riches. And, you know, and I think that's actually there's a really important point in there about the way that rich people frame themselves, the way that, you know, and you find this, you know, if I may, you find this all over Twitter, you find this in, you know, mainstream news all the time, where, you know, someone who isn't a Vanderbilt will frame themselves as being, you know, one of the little guys. Landlord Twitter is like this. If you follow Landlord Twitter, oh my God, you know, you get these people who own like 17 properties, but say, oh, I'm not one of those big companies. No, me, I'm just a little guy, you know,
I own a few buildings. Thing, because it's like, that actually does, like, the idea of the mom and pop landlord, like, it's such a stupid fucking thing to say.
But yeah, of course.
It really is, like, it really is, to me, like, it's very, very disgusting to me to hear people in that sort of position say something like that, because when you hear the phrase, if you're, you know, if you're not as cynical as we are, if you hear the phrase mom and pop landlord, you think of there's a very specific thing that you think of.
Yeah, I think of an old Portuguese man who's owned this house since like they immigrated here in the 1920s, never ups the rent, you know, yeah. Is kindly, takes care of everything, you know, like that's a mom and pop landlord.
Has to pay the mortgage somehow.
Yes, exactly.
And the way that they do it is by renting out their bottom suite.
Exactly.
That's the people who own the house I live in and the people who owned it before them. And like, you know what? It's such a different, the mechanism is the same and it's a bad mechanism. And ultimately at the end of the day, I am subsidizing their housing, not the other way around.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it almost feels like there should be a different word for that because the role is so, and the reason for it is a very different thing. And the idea of someone being like, well, I only own 5 properties. I'm a mom and pop landlord. It's like, fuck you, man.
Yeah.
You're not trying to just retire into this house. Like,
And it's the presentation of it. It's the way in which that type of person frames themselves as the little guy. That's what really irks me. Frankly, at some level, I don't mind. If you're a landlord, you own 17 properties and you just say, yeah, I'm a landlord. This is what I do. I profit from people that need housing. This is what I do. I don't mind that as much as I mind the ones that claim a certain kind of like, I'm one of the little guys, I'm like you, and no, you're not. And that's what I, you know, to come back to that character of Charity, it's like, that's, I think, who's being signaled in that character is someone who, like pretends to be of a certain sort of working class, you know, background, but it's bullshit. And by extension, she is one of the most vicious members of the satanic cult family. So.
Yeah. Well, I was talking to a friend of mine who's a film industry. He does sound for movies. And he was kind of talking about that dynamic in film. And I think it's a dynamic that we've all seen anywhere if we've had a job that is often like the person who has the real money can often afford to look at life through rose-colored glasses.
Yeah.
And be pretty positive and be like, oh, no, yeah, we want to pay our employees good wages because it makes them work better and be happier or whatever. And then that message, and, you know, it's bullshit, don't get me wrong, but then that message gets translated through some kind of middle management type.
Yeah.
And any sort of earnest belief in anything, in it, just in anything positive, or just a belief in anything really, gets siphoned through just a completely cynical operator like Charity, and it just becomes totally bloodless or whatever. I agree with you. I don't think she is like I think the only person in the movie who's coded as having been even just middle class or normal amount of money to have is Grace, the main character.
Yeah.
And it's mentioned in the Wikipedia article that she is a former foster child, which I didn't catch.
It actually comes up a couple times.
Okay.
Right at the start. They're, you know, like the rich people are sort of you know, judging her, and it's set up in a way that you think that that's just like, oh, they're just judging her for, you know, being poor or something like that.
Sure.
In particular, I think it's the character Helene, the aunt, who is especially kind of cold to Grace when she first enters the family at the wedding scene.
The one who most looks like a character in a horror movie.
Yeah.
And is easily the most dedicated to the rigid sort of ideas about how the family is supposed to behave, the most rigid interpretation of, you know, the satanic ritual thing that we are about to talk about, that is kind of the central thing that drives the movie. She's the, immediately when the movie starts, you're like, oh, this person is like the big bad or whatever. Right. As you were saying though, Aunt Helene, Is that how you pronounce it? It's a French name, right?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, if we understand the movie as presenting us with these different versions of the sociopathic Rich, she's an interesting one too, because, you know, you mentioned that off the top, the opening sequence is a flashback to 30 years ago when there's this obviously scary, murderous thing taking place in the house. And we find out later that it is her, I guess, you know, would have been her husband who is being hunted and killed in that opening flashback. And so then 30 years later, here she is. She's the most villainous looking, the most committed to the satanic rituals that they're going to do. And it's a bit like she's sort of been traumatized by the milieu of these sociopathic rich people into whatever, I don't know what the psychology term for it would be, but where you take it on, you know, the thing that has traumatized you, you take it on and you become it, and you become it even more than anyone else. You know, so in some ways, she's actually one of the most sympathetic ones of all of them.
Yeah, because, it's a strange thing, isn't it? Yeah.
Right? You can sort of say to yourself, shit, you know, like, she experienced the worst of what these people do. And, you know, instead of like being able to cope with it or trying to run away or fight back, she just basically sort of internalized it and became it. In my most, most generous moments, when I think about these families, and if you've ever watched any of the reality shows about really rich families, or, you know, think about the Trumps, like they actually are, they tend to be really crazy, really fucked up families.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not even to sort of dip a toe into the world of probably sexual violence, sexual assault, harassment, and so on that happens. So in my most generous moments, I can sort of say, you know, some of these people who do become part of the psychopathic ruling class, you know, they were kids once, you know, and at some point, some of them probably got traumatized pretty badly into this. You know, not that I'm going to stop being a materialist, but
no, of course not.
You know, that is part of.
I will say, I've always said, like, the biggest one that I make this case with is the royals, right? In England, but also you could easily stretch that out to any inherited wealth, and particularly, you know, the American royalty, right? That the people talk about, right? Is that the best case against the royals existing is how fucking miserable all the royals are. Really? Yeah. Like that sounds funny. Like it's not the best case. The best case is what a just obscene waste of resources and money it is, but by the same token, like, these people that have all this money and all this power, they don't even like it. It's because it sucks. Because you have to fucking do you know, you have to fucking get, you know, like, I don't have no sympathy for the royals, but, like, you know, you get hounded by people every day and you have to do the same shit all the time, and you can't, like, just have like a semi-regular life, which is why you know, Harry is the you know, I won't get into any of that bullshit celeb, you know, Harry and Meghan stuff or whatever, but it's why, you know, Harry is the only normal-ish one.
Yeah,
because he just had a point where he was like, oh, I can actually walk away from this. That's what I'm going to do. And it probably, man, just as a side note, I know this is a real tangent, but, like, do you think Elizabeth had to have fucking hated that kid? Like, like, first of all, he's not even Charles's son. He's very clearly like the son of Diana and her old driver, who looks exactly like Harry. And then, you know, you spend your entire like young adult life just like getting drunk, getting photographed wearing a Nazi armband,
Nazi outfits,
and, like, you know, just being a general, just you know, shit disturber or whatever, and then you marry a black woman and then leave the family, oh man,
Yeah, after all those years of being like the troubled partying one, and suddenly he's going to have like a backbone about the way that the royals treat one another.
Totally. Very, very funny.
It's all so stupid and funny. And I mean, I remember vaguely remember seeing something about in the Queen during her last like hours or whatever. And there was some question of whether Meghan Markle was going to like come to visit the Queen in her last hours.
Yeah,
and
totally.
The Queen said no, like at a, you know, I think
that's
the Onion.
So funny.
Yeah. Onion had some kind of like, you know, touching moment, you know, Queen uses her last opportunity to be a racist, whatever, you know,
to Meghan Markle. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man, the Anyways. Nazi armband thing is so funny too, because like, I don't know, especially with the way things have gone, like a part of me almost wonders if that was a bit of a self-aware, like, you know, jab by Harry just being like, well, I'll say the quiet part loud, basically, right. You know, but anyways, that leaves us to, we are going to finally get to the ritual here in just a second, but that leaves us with just one more couple that is in the family to introduce, which is probably, you know, the characters that have the least amount of screen time, but are maybe my favorite. The youngest daughter, or not youngest daughter, but the youngest family, the youngest of the children and only daughter, Emily, who is a absolutely just cocaine addicted party fail daughter.
Yeah.
And her husband, whose name escapes me, but
Fitch.
Is just a Fitch. That's right. Yeah, Fitch. Yeah. Just a fat, oafish, just dumb man who is the dumbest guy in the movie. No question.
Yeah, yeah.
And both of them are very funny. And
Fitch is comically in over his head. Like, he just has no idea. You know, he clearly went in his initiation into the family. He had an easy one.
Yes.
And, you know, he's sort of like, he's on his phone half the time, you know, hoping that they can leave soon. Like he's clearly in over his head.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, and we will get a little bit more to them in a minute, but I want to finally get to the event that drives the plot of the movie. So it's revealed after Alex and Grace get married that there is an initiation into the family where after you get married, you have to play a game with the family. And it doesn't matter what the outcome of the game is. You just have to play it. And then after you've played it, you're initiated into the family. And that's the way that it's initially explained to her by her husband, Alex. But when they finally sit down to do the game, to play the game, we get a little bit more backstory, and Tony describes how several hundred years ago, I guess, or a couple hundred years ago anyways, the original patriarch of the family, Victor, was on a boat with a man named and met a man named Mr. LaBelle. And Mr. LaBelle is, I think, very obviously meant to be the devil.
Yes.
LaBelle is an anagram for Belial, which is a name that, like, it's a less common name that's been associated with the devil, but it is present in both the Old Testament and the Talmud, or the Torah, and it's generally associated with being Satan, but it's a more archaic and sort of less used one. And so basically a long, long time ago, Victor, the head of the patriarch of the family, made this deal with the devil that he was gonna, you know, amass this huge amount of wealth, but in return, everyone who's initiated in the family has to play a game. You draw that game out of a little card box. And so they bring the box goes around in a circle and finally ends up at Grace, and she pulls a card, and the card she pulls is hide and seek. And this is the catch, I suppose, which is that if you draw hide and seek, that what that actually means is that you go and hide, and when the family goes to try and find you, what they're actually trying to do is to find you and kill you, or more accurately, maim you, so that they can take you into a room and perform a satanic ritual where they, I think, like, drink your blood and say "Hail Satan" or something like that, and then kill you.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is, you know, I have some issues with the way this movie concludes, but I will say that the one redeeming thing about it is that even if they didn't go full tilt in their criticism of rich people, or as full tilt as I thought they could have anyways, the idea that all rich people made a deal with Satan to be rich is a good, like, that's a good thing to fall back on, you know? Yeah. Yeah. So she draws the card. She doesn't really know what's going on, but she goes and hides, and the family gets all their old, it should be noted, weapons together. It's all like era specific weaponry that they take off the walls in the room and go to find Grace with. And so what eventually happens is Grace ends up in her bedroom with Alex, and Alex kind of, you know, puts the hand over her mouth, makes sure she's really quiet, and she overhears the family explain what's going on. And then in a hilariously recurring bit, sees the daughter, Emily, accidentally kill the help, one of the maids in the house. Mm-hmm. And this is a recurring joke where Emily is so high and such a fail daughter that she keeps routinely killing the wrong person. And so she'll put a crossbow spike through like the maid's mouth. She shoots another waiter or something. It's a recurring gag over and over again. It's one of the funnier things in the movie, I would say.
Yeah, it's just the way in which, like, even in the context of this deadly ritual, the help are still considered irrelevant and background, and it's the flippancy, after she accidentally harpoons one of them. Yeah, you know, and what the family is most worried about is like, shit, you got the wrong one. You didn't, like, this was, what a waste of an arrow, basically. Which, like, I mean, the film is blunt. Like, it's not subtle. No. There's nothing subtle about the critique. And so that's fine. Like, once you figure out that that's what it's going for, it's like, yep, okay. You know, of course, they don't give a shit about the help. They consider them barely even collateral damage. And I will say this, one of the things that's pretty interesting about that is that most of the help do get murdered, except for one guy who ends up helping them to catch her in the end. He's sort of like a butler or something. And, you know, he, out of, I guess, his loyalty to the rich family, helps them carry out the ritual. And I had mixed feelings about that. I thought, like, I know
exactly what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. You're right. Like, I would have liked to have had, like, let them all either be victims or in solidarity with her.
What I will say is I don't hate the, okay. So basically, just to attach this to the plot of the movie, at this point, we basically get a bunch of intercut vignettes of Grace being chased, being presented with some kind of problem, getting injured in some way, like just it becomes a classic chase movie, right? And the first person that she kind of comes into contact with, Alex goes and disarms the security system so that she can get out. And the first person that is blocking her way is this guy that you just mentioned, Stevens, he's called. He's the butler.
Yeah.
And I don't hate his characterization because I think it kind of ties into what I was saying about middle management people earlier, where sometimes it does seem fair to me that the family butler would be the one of the most dedicated soldiers in the whole thing. And he's also more menacing because he actually, unlike all of the family members who, in another recurring gag, all totally fail at trying to catch this woman because none of them can aim a crossbow. And none of them, and this is another funny, I think, critique of inherited wealth, which is that, you know, we really have reached the point, I think, in capitalism where, you know, for to... You know, the idea of like the self-made man is already bullshit, obviously. But there was a there, you know, 100 years ago, there were very rich people who could be considered at the very least to be to have a talent for it, to have done something, to have had some kind of creativity or even just ruthlessness that gave that helped them gain their position. But we've reached the point now where all of those attributes have totally atrophied, and you just these rich people that can't do anything to save their life. And
don't get me started. This is my whole theory about the last 30 years is that we've entered this dumb stage of capitalism in North America where the ruling class is they've believed that the children of the you know, the Reaganites who said things they didn't believe to bullshit us. But their children believed it, and their children are now running the show as if the things that the Reaganites said were right and actually made sense when they didn't. It was bullshit. And so, you take any example, whether it's COVID or anything else, the bungling, the utter self-inflicted wounds, bungling of ruling our society is in part because I just think we've entered the dumbest phase. They're going to lose this damn Cold War, like this new Cold War with China. They're going to lose because Chinese capital and Chinese capitalists are just smarter at this stage. So
1,000%. It's not even close. The American ruling class is not only evil, they are also stupid now.
Yeah.
And that's a very, very strange combo. And this movie gets into that by just routinely showing even like Charity. There's a scene, I believe, where Charity aims the crossbow at Grace while she's running. And it's from a reasonable distance. But Charity does not even get close. She fires the arrow probably about 20 feet in the air above where Grace is, not even where Grace is standing, above where she was 10 seconds before she fired it, you know, right? It's just not even close. And so that's a very funny recurring thing as well.
Which also I think is why I found the Tony Soprano thing kind of worked for me, because in a certain way, you know, Tony Soprano is this guy who is watching the whole mobster world around him get stupid and be stupid. And he's smart enough to know that it's all getting really stupid and he hates it and he's tired of it, but he's not smart enough to really know how to stop it or get out of it or stop being
what to do about it.
Yeah. Right. And that's kind of like the dad, the patriarch of the family, who is watching his children fail at performing a completely insane satanic ritual. Because they're all so useless. And so he's got to do it himself somehow. He's got to figure out how to do it. But he doesn't want to because he wants to just play golf tomorrow. Right? It's this whole kind of absurd, right? Just this absurd
situation.
You think
situation. I wanted it to go like this? Right? I have an 8 a.m. tea time tomorrow. Very good. So the first person that she sort of encounters in her many misadventures is Stevens, the butler, who she tries to shoot him with her gun, and then it turns out that the ammo is display only, and so she hits him with a boiling teapot and burns up the side of his face. And what I will say is I didn't have a problem with his characterization, but at every turn, like, there's another scene very quickly afterwards where it is funny. It's a what appears to be a maid or something she's hiding in a dumb waiter, and she screams at the family that Grace is there.
Oh yeah, right? Yeah, right. Which, right,
and
right.
And this is sort of like, it is a funny scene because she also says, she's like, I don't even know why I'm here. I can't clean a house or anything.
Yeah.
Tony just likes the way I dance.
Yeah.
You know, which is very and then she gets crushed to death by the dumbwaiter. And interestingly, despite the fact that that she screamed to let the family in on where Grace was, Grace still tries to get her out of the dumbwaiter.
Yeah.
Like, she still tries to save her, which is interesting.
Yeah. I had forgotten. It's funny. I had forgotten about that scene, and it's actually one of the scenes I liked the most. Because unlike the waiter or the butler guy, where I found it a little bit harder to sort of understand, I didn't feel like it was laid out very well. That one to me was laid out really well, where it's like, look, underneath in the kind of ephemera and debris around these rich families are all of the people that get like crushed by them and who are so small by comparison. And so, you know, yeah, if you're asking for like some kind of working class solidarity between this maid who isn't even really a maid, who is treated terribly by the family, and this woman who's marrying into it, good luck. I mean, you know, this isn't 1917. This isn't Red October. It isn't all perfectly coming together. The working class in capitalism right now, despite the fact that capitalism is exposed as an idiotic and insane way of running society, and so many people intuitively know that, try getting three people in a room together who agree that we should do something, and this is what it is. Solidarity is so broken and fractured and fragmented. And so, you know, that scene to me is like actually really rings true.
And so what I will say is I love the scene as well, but I remember thinking in that moment after that happened, like, if there isn't at least one person in this movie who tries to show solidarity with Grace, I'm going to be slightly disappointed.
Sure.
And that is what ended up happening. There are no other good people in this movie. And so to get into some of the other vignettes, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do them in order because it all kind of bleeds together for me, but there's a part where she runs into Daniel, and Daniel kind of indicates that he thinks this is insane and ridiculous, but he keeps saying over and over again, he says multiple times, I'm weak. I don't feel like I can do anything about this, but he gives her a 10 second head start. And then there's another part where she runs out into like the barn area where they keep all their goats, which eventually you realize is because they just sacrifice goats all the time for reasons that are never entirely explained. And this scene is both one of the most horrifying and also one of the most funny. She ends up in there and she runs into one of the little boys, who I believe the two little boys are Daniel and Charity's little kids, I think. And so she runs into the one of their little boys in this barn, and she's like, oh my God, you're here. Like, okay, everything's okay. You know, it's going to be fine, you know, yada, 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 or whatever. And she's sort of trying to talk him into helping her, and he just pulls a gun on her and shoots her right through the hand.
Yeah.
It goes all the way through. She has a giant hole in her hand. And she is like, Jesus, what the fuck? And she just punches the kid in the face. Yeah. And the kid goes out cold. And then she gets startled by a goat. And she falls into this big pit that is just filled with carcasses. And I thought this was very interesting, because I believe it's Alex says, or a couple of them even say, Alex and Daniel, maybe they say multiple times that, well, no one ever fucking pulls this card. Like it almost never happens.
Yeah.
But if you look at all the bodies that are in this pit, some of them don't look like some of them definitely don't look 30 years old.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's an implication there that even if people don't do this particular ritual that often, they do kill people fairly frequently, or perhaps more aptly, like, you know, a prostitute.
I probably should have said sex worker here. That's my bad.
Dies on the property from an overdose, and they just dump her body in the pit with all the other bodies, you know.
Yeah, well,
something like that.
At the very least, it signals that like this is a household that is has where death visits regularly.
Yes.
And people are fully comfortable with it, which makes sense, because, you know, if it was a ritual that only happened every 30 years or so, you know, you would expect the people involved to be more horrified by it, and none of them are.
No,
you know,
they
may not be very good at shooting a crossbow, but none of them seem, you know, particularly surprised or horrified by what's happening. And, you know, and I really do think that some of the most important characters are the ones who on the surface seem to have an ambiguous relationship to it. Like, yes, the ones who don't obviously like it. Daniel, the brother, the mm-hmm. Fail-son brother, who's like, oh, I'm weak, I'm tired. And you know, I think those are the characters. And I would have actually, I think, liked them to be vilified even more than they are. But
sure.
But him and also the husband himself, Alex, that brings her into it, you know, and then regrets it. And he's going to try to get her out or whatever. But their complicity to me is really significant, right? Because it's
yeah.
it's those kind of apologetic rich people or, you know, the ones who sit beside the rich people and help them pull off their bullshit. You know, you mentioned Obama earlier, like Obama,
yeah.
let's use Obama as an example, right? Because Obama plays himself off as the good guy, the nice guy, you know, and spent 8 years abetting everything that these rich psychopaths ever wanted. And that was part of Obama's ticket into the club, where he remains. He is in the club. He is comfortable in the club.
Making Netflix shows.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And
having giant birthday parties with all the biggest celebrities in the world, you know?
Yeah, like, destroying NBA player strikes and undermining Bernie Sanders' candidacy, right? And continuing to do the work.
Grim Reaper, the picture of Obama dressed like the Grim Reaper at all the doors that say, exactly. like, you know, NBA players strike, Bernie 2020 or whatever. Yeah.
So, you know, that's important. I think that's an important part of the film, is showing those kinds of, like, they perform something, but they are working with the rich. They will kill you just as quickly.
Well, I want to get to Daniel in a second, because he figures into the plot very heavily. But to just sort of put a pin in the series of vignettes, we cut away from the action briefly to Daniel and his father eventually finding Alex and knocking him unconscious and restraining him. And there's an interesting sort of interaction that they have where for a second, Daniel seems to be saying to Alex that he's going to help them get out, and then has actually distracted Alex just long enough for Tony to come up behind him and, you know, knock him on the head unconscious. And so to put a pin in all the vignettes, there's a great scene where Grace pulls herself out of the pit by putting her hand hole on a rusty nail and like pulling herself up. It's very, very it's rough to watch, but it's very good. And then also injures herself again, pulling herself through a fence to get at a car that's passing by. And then she runs out into the road and yells at the car, like screaming, like, help me, help me, help me. She's covered in blood. Her clothes are all ripped up. And then the car stops and the guy rolls down the window and he goes, get out of the fucking road. And then just drives off. And that is very funny.
Yeah.
And she screams, a bunch of obscenities and then says fucking rich people, which I thought was very funny.
Yeah. Again, unsubtle. This is the least subtle.
The least subtle movie ever, which is its strength, I would argue.
Yeah, I think
Its lack of subtlety. Subtlety is overrated.
Yeah.
Sometimes, I think. And so she eventually is able to, I can't remember how exactly this happens, but she's eventually able to steal a car. I believe it's implied to even be Le Domas' car. And so anyway, she gets in the car, she drives away. And she uses the, you know, what are they? It's like OnStar or whatever OnStar, is what they used to call it. But where you have a
live agent on the other end that can help you.
Help you with stuff. And she is like, someone's trying to kill me. I need you to call the cops. And of course, the OnStar guy is like, I can help you with that. And then immediately is like, oh, I'm sorry. Your car has been reported stolen. I have to turn the car off and lock you in it.
Yeah.
Which is pretty good. And so eventually Stevens is able to come and find her. Stevens shoots her with a tranquilizer gun, begins the process of returning her to the house, but she eventually wakes up. And I thought this was also very funny. Stevens is listening to classical music so loud in the car that he can't hear the family on the video call telling him that she's awake behind him and she's going to kick him in the head.
Yeah, which I want to say, I my read on that is again, not super subtle, but this is a guy who is so desperate to be adjacent to the rich that he is, you know, cranking classical music, which presumably no one in the, like, we don't get any indication that anyone in the rich aristocratic family actually listen classical music. They certainly don't think more of him for it. And yet there's this way in which he is just so cloyingly, pathetically trying to be one of them that he's got the classical music cranked. I thought that was good.
And so she eventually, she gets out of this jam, but it doesn't last long because she's eventually apprehended by Daniel and Tony in another sequence where it appears for a second that Daniel might be helping her or might be thinking about helping her, but eventually just leads to them dragging her off to finally perform this ritual that they've been hinting at for the entire movie, where they essentially, they're going to stab her while screaming Hail Satan and drinking blood or goat's blood or her blood or some kind of thing. And so they go to do that. And at the moment that they start to, like, immediately after drinking the blood, they all basically start shitting and vomiting blood profusely. And at this point, Daniel and Grace escape. And it is finally revealed that Daniel has decided to poison the family with a non-lethal dose of hydrochloric acid so that Grace can get away. And I believe he says something like, eventually somebody was going to have to burn it all down. Something like that. And this brings me to something that I kind of alluded to earlier that I think is interesting, which is Daniel's character. The most interesting one in the movie, I think. I found out later, I don't know how this, it must be revealed in the movie somehow, but he is the child at the beginning of the movie who rats out his uncle.
Yeah.
And I think there's, you know, there's a lot going on with this character, but my biggest take on him, my central take on him is that he is essentially the normal one in the family, which is a funny thing to say, because he is so abnormal in a lot of ways. But I think if you were just to take a normal non-psychopathic person and put them in that environment, what would eventually happen is, you know, they would go through the motions, they would marry the hot wife, they would have the kids, and they would rightly become an alcoholic, because the only reasonable response to realizing that you and everyone around you are evil and terrible is to try to drown that out as much as possible. But he's also, you know, I say he's normal, and what I mean by that is to say that he's not a heroic character or a good person. He's just not a terrible person, because he has the at least ability to observe that all of this is not right. And eventually, I think the implication is that he does the right thing out of guilt more than anything else. And I liked his character because I sort of agreed with the observation that, like, this is kind of what a semi-normal person would turn out in this situation. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it's kind of like, you know, once in a while you'll get a whistleblower.
Yes.
You know, in some kind of context where it's maybe a little surprising that there would be a whistleblower, you know, an Edward Snowden, you know, a Chelsea Manning, you know, going back a little ways, but Smedley Butler, who was a U.S. general, and during the 1930s, a group of actually, you know, people who would have been like the owners of this company, the American aristocratic class in the 1930s, who were very pro-fascist, pro-Nazi Germany, hatched a plot to overthrow President Roosevelt and install a fascist dictatorship in the United States. And they
didn't know anything about that.
Oh, yeah. They approached this guy, Smedley Butler, who was a general in the U.S. military, and asked him to be the leader of this coup. And he refuses, you know, after having been a lifetime general in the U.S. military. And at that point, I mean, you know, they invade Latin America like four times a year. They're just totally horrific. And he actually says after that, he becomes an outspoken critic of the U.S. military establishment and says, I was basically a racketeer for capital. And you know, he becomes this really outspoken critic. So, you know, in a certain way, it's like once in a while, you will get these people who, after a long period of sort of quiet defeat and acquiescence, something snaps and they decide to blow the whistle. So I appreciated it. I thought it rang relatively true to, you know, what would be possible in that
exactly
scenario.
in the sense that if you're going to have a character like this, if you have to have one of the rich family members be the good guy,
yes,
or whatever, this is the way to do it, I think.
Yeah,
I think they executed this in a way, you know, like if you want to compare it to, and now I'm revealing that we record these episodes out of order sometimes, but if you want to compare it to the scene in Judas and the Black Messiah that we both got so, or that you in particular got so angry about, where it's almost trying to show you that, oh, well, the FBI guy, he isn't really so bad.
Yeah.
And it just feels totally like from another movie.
Yeah.
And like
contrived,
it's like,
and yeah,
it's, you know, trying to pull punches with its central observation. This movie is not doing that.
No,
it's just offering up the best sort of, in the best possible way, like a character that isn't wholly terrible.
Yeah. Okay. So if that's not the thing that bothered you, because I figured there's one of two things that would have bothered you. So if it's not that, then I think we must have been bothered by the same thing at the end.
Yes. So okay. we get to basically the final showdown here, where Grace eventually escapes and beats the ever loving shit out of Andy McDowell with a brick. Like, I think with the card box, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Brings it down on Andy McDowell's head over and over again. And Alex sees this and I would argue quite predictably turns on her.
Oh, yeah.
And
for sure.
And I knew this was coming right from the get-go. It becomes very obvious that, you know, I mean, let's be real here. Why would you ever get fucking married if you're in this family?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like if I was in this family, my wife, it took her a really long time to finally convince me to get married, because in my family, everybody who got married, that relationship failed. They were then they're the next person that they ended up with for a really long time. They were with for a decade before they ever got married or whatever. Right.
Right. Right.
And so I was like, marriage, I don't know. You know, it's just I don't really care that much about it or whatever. And then eventually she was like, I really want to. And I was like, OK, fine. Great. But if I was from a family like this, I would have explained that to her like 6 months in.
Yeah.
Like, you just need to know we're never getting married. And this is why.
Yeah.
So it's not surprising that when it all comes down to it, he reveals himself to be very possessive, et cetera, et cetera. And so finally, we end up with, at the moment where you think she's gonna finally, you know, where we reach the how's she gonna get out of this one moment, where the whole remaining members of the family all convene in the same room, and then the sun comes up and it's like, oh, they didn't do it. They didn't succeed. And the sun beats down on them and they all prepare to die in some way, to get killed.
Because the satanic ritual has failed. They had to kill her by before the sun came up, or, you know, Satan
was
going to
die.
Yeah. Exactly.
I don't know if I actually explained that.
Yeah. Important because they all justify it at some level that way, or at least some of them, you know, will justify to themselves and to Grace, like, look, I'm really sorry. I don't want to kill you, but if I don't do this, like,
then
I'm going to
die.
We're all going to die because someone all those years ago made this deal with the devil, this Faustian bargain, and now we're stuck in it. We're really, really sorry, but we have to make this choice. And so they
all realize, like, that the sun comes up and nothing happens. And so they go, oh, well, shit, guess we still have to kill her. Which is funny, and that is a good, that part of the ending is good, because
perfect.
I do like the them just being like, oh, well, okay, I guess it was bullshit, but we still have to kill her.
Yeah.
You know, no remorse, no punches pulled whatsoever.
Yeah, that's where it should, should be, yes, that's perfect up to there.
But then a few more moments pass, and all of the members of the family start imploding, and guts fly everywhere, and it looks good. And it's a like the sequence is fun to watch, especially because it's also implied that the two little kids explode.
Yeah.
But I think ultimately you and I are going to have the same issue with it, which is that it is a punch pull at the very end that kind of makes all of the evil rich people seem not, you know, they'll never seem sympathetic, but it gives them the out. It gives them the excuse of why they did it. And if I had, now I read about the initial ending of this movie was going to be that nothing happens and they kill her, but they decided that that was too dark. And honestly, I'll split the difference here by saying that it would have been better, no question, for them for it to not end this way. Like, it would have been better. What would have been the best ending would have been for her to find a way to escape.
Sure.
And to kill and for them to all burn down with the house or something. That would have been the best ending, because I am sympathetic to wanting to give it a cathartic ending where the hero escapes.
Yeah, but it should be her that does it.
Not this Satan. Deus Ex Machina thing where, you know, where they all explode and it gives them the out, because it cheapens the satire and the critique of the rest of the movie.
It absolutely does. It absolutely does. Like, it's a common type of cop-out that you find in movies like this. I wasn't shocked, but I was totally disappointed, because it means that retrospectively, every time a character said, look, I'm really sorry, I don't want to kill you, the last thing I want to do is kill you, you seem cool, but I got to do this, otherwise it's my ass and everyone else that I love. So, and that's garbage.
It is and garbage, yeah.
That ending actually validates it and is like, oh no, actually they really had to, because Satan really was going to explode everyone if they didn't do it. And so I think, yeah, it pissed me off. I thought it kind of cheapened the ending considerably. I have one defense of it.
Yes.
And unfortunately, I do not think the film is sophisticated enough for this to have been what it was about. This is like me wishing it into being.
Totally. Yeah.
But a really sophisticated understanding of capitalism would actually lead you to a certain conclusion, which is that if you are the capitalist, you have no choice but to continue being a ruthless capitalist, the most ruthless capitalist. Otherwise, you will not survive as a capitalist. Mm-hmm. It's a great line in the Communist Manifesto where Marx and Engels say that need of capital chases the bourgeoisie around the world.
Yeah.
And the way they phrase that, right? They don't say that the bourgeoisie is chasing capital around the world, but need of capital is chasing the bourgeoisie. The rich are the chased. They are being chased by this insatiable hunger that capital has, and capital must be fed. And I mean, look, there is some truth in this. If you are a small capitalist, your chances of surviving as a capitalist are very small. You know, 95% of small businesses go bankrupt. You have to be ruthless as a small business if you're going to become a mid-sized business. By the time you're a mid-sized business, you're fighting with tough competition to survive. If you're going to become the next Walmart, you have to exploit labor. You have to cut corners, exploit the environment. You have to do these things all the way up the top, where as a capitalist, you actually do have very little choice. The choice that you have is to say, I feel sick to my stomach doing these things. I'm no longer going to be a capitalist. Welcome to the working class, right? You've made that choice, but guess what? It sucks down here, like, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's hard to even really want that out of anyone. Like it's always there.
Yeah.
It's always there to say, and for the record, particularly in the history of left politics, like the history of left politics is riddled with people like that who did actually do that. On some level, you know, or
Marx and Engels themselves are class traitors.
The most classic example, Engels in particular.
Engels for
but also someone like Robert Owen, you know, one of the early utopian socialists who, you know, went bankrupt trying to turn his factory and everything into a little like utopian socialist community, et cetera. You know, there's a lot of them, but I agree with you. Like it. If it had been executed better, you could maybe make the case that it's not such a bad ending. But
it was not, to be clear. Yeah, it was not. I don't think I wish that the film had that level of sort of analysis happening, but I don't think it did. And so I was disappointed.
The way the movie should have ended is not only, oh, it's bullshit, but someone or a lot of them even saying, somebody at least saying, like, of course it's bullshit.
Yeah.
This is insane.
Yeah.
This is ridiculous. We do this because, you know,
Or her just killing them. Like,
yeah.
I would love for them to die. I would love for justice to be served here.
Yeah.
And I want them to be proven to be psychopaths whose satanic thing is just cover for the fact that they're psychopaths. And then in that moment, she enacts justice. That would have been a really satisfying ending. You know, whatever. It was not a movie that I watched. I quickly understood what I was getting into, that this was like a sort of wham bam kind of, this is what evil capitalists are like, fuck these people. And I didn't expect more than that. So, you know, I'm nitpicking about the ending, I think, ultimately, because it was still a pretty satisfying, you know, overall thing.
Oh, yeah. And for me, it's the difference between it being a great movie and a good movie.
Yeah.
And ultimately, when I rated this on Letterboxd, I gave it a 4 out of 5. Rather than the 4.5 I was flirting with, if they were going to go full tilt and show some solidarity and have the right ending for it.
Mm-hmm.
Just by pure virtue of it being as fun as it is, as good looking as it is, as tense as it is. I was genuinely very tense for most of the run of the movie. I thought it did that very well. It's very funny. It can get, some of the banter can get a little too like soy Marvel.
Yeah.
Joss Whedon, but if you're gonna do that, I do think it works a lot better when it's your bad guys that talk like that than your heroes, because it's such a smarmy, detestable kind of way of speaking. But it is still very funny. Like the we didn't really talk about him that much, but the Fitch character is very funny. There's like a scene where he's locked in a bathroom watching a YouTube video on how to use a crossbow. There's another scene where he gets a text from like one of his buddies, and he's like reading it out loud, and he's like chuckling to himself, and he's like, what up, dog? And then and then he's like, and then his friend's like, oh, what are you up to? And then he's just like, and he's like he's talking, like he says what he's typing, which is such a perfect like dumb guy thing to do. And he just goes, not much family shit. it's very funny. You know, there's no part, like, it's not like there's any scene in the movie other than the ending where I thought to myself, this doesn't need to be here, or I don't like this, or this is boring.
No, it's well edited.
And even the ending itself, it's not a bad ending in the sense that, like I said, like, it's a fun to watch.
Yeah.
It's enjoyable. The rich people get what's coming to them. It's just that thematically it's disappointing, and it feels like it's from a different movie.
It's a good movie ending. It's just not a good ending to the analysis that the movie had.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. I think that pretty much sums it up. So what would you give this movie?
I'm back and forth, but I think I'm gonna lean somewhere between a 3.5 and a 4 stars.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair.
You know, I for me, it's also because I watched it in as part of that canon of new anti-capitalist movies. And I think I said, I don't think we were rolling yet, but, you know, I feel like there was a shift around 2008 with the 2008 crash. And I remember really shortly after the 2008 crash, the movie Tower Heist came out. And like, it's a bit of an obscure title, but it was this kind of like, I don't know, medium budget heist movie, Ben Stiller, Alan Alda, featuring a horrifically corrupt, greedy Wall Street executive and the workers in his building where he lives, his penthouse, kind of like come together to rob him. And it was so satisfying. It wasn't the greatest movie ever made, but it was extremely satisfying because it felt like I had not seen in so long. I had not seen like just a straight up mainstream fuck the rich kind of movie. And since then, you know, I feel like that's happening more and more and more, and in newer and different ways. This movie fits into that for sure. It's not among the most interesting, entries into that thing, but it's certainly like a satisfying, simple one. So Yeah, 3.5 to 4 stars is probably where I
am. And I would argue among the most fun as well.
Definitely fun.
Because it's definitely a lot more fun than, it's more fun than I would argue even like Get Out, which is a superior movie.
Oh yeah, Get Out is definitely superior and also a tougher watch.
Exactly. Definitely. Yeah, this one was very joyful, which is kind of what I liked about it. I liked that it was a very zippy, fun, gleeful movie about how rich people suck and they will eventually get their comeuppance.
Yeah.
And I do agree with you that it's a thing that seems way more present now in filmmaking than it was certainly like when I was a kid anyways, like in the 90s and into the early 2000s. It just seems like it's not that there weren't movies that were critical of capitalism. There always have been and always will be, but they just felt more muted.
Yeah.
Or they couldn't be, or they had to be very subtle, or there had to be some kind of caveat to it. Like the problem was not capitalism, but corporatism.
Yeah, right.
Crony
yeah.
capitalism.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
Or yada, yada, yada.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
This movie and others like Get Out, and even I would argue even Jordan Peele's other movies as well.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you mentioned Knives Out, Parasite. There's many of them. They're more explicit in like, no, this rich people are bad.
Yeah.
and in some cases, even, you know, the capitalism is bad. The system is bad. The whole thing is rotten. It's garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that pretty much concludes episode on Ready or Not. Happy Halloween to all those who celebrate. it was nice to do a horror movie, and I look forward to doing more horror movies in the future. Anything to close out on, Tyler? Anything else you want to say?
No, I think I just close out by saying, you know, spooky season is probably the most Marxist of holidays.
Yes.
If anyone has read Marx's Capital, it's filled with references to zombies and vampires. You know, Capital is vampire-like, sucking the blood of the working class, you know, those kinds of lines. So, this is definitely the season to celebrate for those of us on the left. So,
although I will say this Christmas, we will be doing what I consider to be not only another anti-capitalist classic, but my favorite movie ever, which is It's a Wonderful Life. So I look forward to doing that one at Christmas because it is kind of the one exception to the rule of Christmas movies all kind of being extremely consumerist and pro-establishment, except for maybe A Christmas Carol, I guess would be the other exception. But
yeah, Christmas Story.
Oh yeah, you're right. Yeah. Actually. Yeah. That's another good one. Those are the three really good. The Mount Rushmore of Christmas movies is It's a Wonderful Life, Alistair Sim, Christmas Carol, or Muppets Christmas Carol. Even
Muppets is good.
I'll allow you to have that one. Yeah. A Christmas Story and Elf. Those are the four. Those are like the four good Christmas movies.
I'll so anyways, Kiss Bang Bang. That's my other.
Oh, I've Christmas never seen
movie.
That.
That's a good one too. Yeah.
That'll be
our Christmas episode.
If you want to get into fucking, you know, Die Hard and shit, or like movies that take place at Christmas time or whatever.
Yeah, I know. It gets a little unwieldy. I know.
Yeah, that's a little preview for a couple months down the road. Some things you might hear us talk about. So thanks for listening, everybody. And we'll see you next time.